Well, we know that there are a lot of events that transpired this past year that we see summarized on the news. It seems like the news has been summarizing these events for the last 3 days now and will continue to do so. And also we see that there have been decisions that have been made in the highest position in this land, that is with the U.S. presidency, and decisions that have been made by our brother in England, in this case our sister in England, with the Brexit, that's a Britain exit that we call it, it's a Brexit, that will have far-reaching, maybe not so far, but at least a few years reaching out consequences for what will be happening in the world. Today I'm giving a sermon that I hope will expand our mind a little bit, because as I've been listening to the news and what leaders throughout the world are deciding, we all of us, and I think you do, it's not just me who thinks in terms of prophecies, but all of us need to be thinking how the leadership, not only in the United States, but leaders throughout the world fit into God's overall plan. I think we used the term with the radio broadcast years ago. Some of you remember the term, and that was the Bible shedding light on world events, or world events in light of Bible prophecy. Maybe that was the way it was termed. But we remember where the focus has always been in what's happening in this world, that we look at the Bible to see how what is taking place fits into what God said would take place, the predicaments of God, the prophecies of God. So, again, I want to focus, and we're not going to be picking on any leaders in a wrong way, because we'll see that the leaders that are making decisions now at this end time and for, no doubt, millennia, have been chosen by God to fulfill his plan. So let's turn to Isaiah 55 and verse 8. Isaiah 55 and verse 8. The sermon will focus in definitely on the United States, because the United States has a lot to do with allowing events to transpire in such a way that they otherwise would not have, if decisions were not made the way that they are being made right now. So we go to a prophecy in Isaiah 55, or basically a statement of what it is, and that is a little bit out of context, I would say. The context of the statement here is not based on what I'm talking about today, but the principle stands very solid. Here we find in verse 7, "Let the wicked forsake his way." Again, Isaiah 55 and verse 7. "Let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord, and he will have mercy on him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon." In other words, the wicked are not going to be thinking the way God thinks, because that's what verse 8 now speaks of. "My thoughts are not your thoughts." Okay, the wicked do not think like God thinks. The world doesn't think like God thinks. "My thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways." Now, morally speaking, definitely, but what we're looking at is an overall plan of God where we concentrate on the politics in the United States, or we just had an article in the Discern magazine on Venezuela. So we can read that, and we can center on what is going on in Venezuela and how they were such a strong economy in 2001. I have this on my mind because I read it just before I went to bed last night. But now they're one of the worst economies. I think every 5 weeks in Venezuela during 2018, you had double inflation. In other words, the dollar was worth only half in 5 weeks, and then it was only worth half in another 5 weeks. We see local things that are happening, small things compared to the way God thinks. Low things, I guess. When you speak of the word higher, God's mind is higher than ours. So we think in terms of the President of the United States, for example, making decisions about the wall. And you think, well, how does that fit into prophecy? And the answer is, well, I think it does, because it's allowing strangers to come into the country, and basically, given enough time, you're going to have the strangers who have more of their nationality in the country than we as Manasseh. In other words, we are an Israelitish country, and in time then, there's going to be more people that are from outside the country than from in. That's at least what they say. Isn't it true of California, for sure? So it does fit in a little bit into prophecies in the Bible. But we get into the local politics. How does having 800,000 government employees being paid, plus another 400,000, I don't know what it is totally, but how does that fit into prophecy? It does in general ways, but you have specific decisions that are being made that really fit into the politics of the nations. In fact, that was the name of a book, Politics Among the Nations, years ago. And I forget the author right now. But God's ways are higher, so we don't think, you know, we have, when we think about the presidency throughout the years, I remember being involved listening to my parents when they were talking politics. One year my father voted Republican and my mother voted Democrat. She voted on the basis of the handsomeness of the president running. Literally, she did. If the guy was handsome, she liked him. Or if the wife didn't look like my mom thought she should have looked, she wouldn't have voted for the husband. So that was her basis of voting. You know, really a very high way of thinking, isn't it? But we have all of these, you know, areas of dispute, and we get very involved, and we're not thinking the way God thinks. Romans 9, verses 14 through 24, 3. Romans 9, it's very interesting. When God makes a decision to put somebody in office, he has a reason for it that's a longstanding reason. Romans chapter 9, verses 14 through 23. I think this is one of the best examples of God's intervention in the governments of mankind. Romans chapter 9, I'll get to it here. Okay, verse 14. Romans 9, 14. What shall we say then? Is there righteousness with God? Unrighteousness, excuse me. Certainly not. For he says to Moses, I will have mercy on whomever I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whomever I will have compassion. So then, it is not of him who wills, nor of him who runs for office. I added that. It's not in the Bible. Or runs. But of God who shows mercy. For the scripture says to Pharaoh. So now, you're getting into a choice of a government leader in this case. The scripture says to Pharaoh, even for this same purpose I have raised you up. So God has raised up a leader that I might show my power in you, that my name might be declared in all the earth. So what happened in that situation? Well, Pharaoh wouldn't let him go. And God had raised this very strong, determined mind fellow, Pharaoh, to be in the office at the time that Moses would come along, and this man was not going to give in to Moses. He was going to be so stubborn that God would have to show his glory, show his power, in order for all mankind to be able to look back. In fact, you can read in the Psalms, this is in so many scriptures in the Bible that refer back to the time when God brought the children of Israel out of Egypt in a very powerful and a strong way. But God raised the Pharaoh up. If there could have been a man there who, after, you know, just one problem that comes along, one miracle that God shows, and he says, you're out of here. But this guy is not going to let him go. He's not going to let him go. And Egypt was literally destroyed because of what God did, because of Pharaoh's stubbornness. Therefore, verse 18, he has mercy on whom he wills, and whom he wills he hardens. So he hardened Pharaoh. He allowed Satan to harden Pharaoh, is what he did. So you will say to me then, well, why does he still find fault if God is doing this? Well, he's not doing this with righteous people. He's doing this with unrighteous people who are going to be, you know, they're sinners and they're not going to follow God's way anyway. So he just chooses to allow to harden them and get the worst out of them. It's in them because human nature is not a nature that is subject to the law of God and cannot be. We know that. So it's not like God is taking someone who otherwise would have been fine. No, Pharaoh would not have been fine. But indeed, O man, who are you to reply against God? Will the thing formed say to him who formed it, why have you made me thus? Does not the potter have power over the clay from the same lump to make the one vessel for honor and another for dishonor? Now, that doesn't mean Pharaoh won't have a chance. But Pharaoh may be one of the first converted in the second resurrection. So it's not God being unfair. God uses the nature of human beings to fulfill his plan. And then he goes on. We don't need to continue, but it just shows how high God's mind is, how he thinks, and how human beings think. You know, we have human beings who think that the Indians should have their territory back. And it's like, you know, the Indians would have destroyed themselves. God does not come in and allow a whole nation to be destroyed, man, woman, and child, unless they are so far down that there is no chance at all for a good society to be developed out of that culture that has degenerated for hundreds and hundreds of years in some cases. So God, in fact, when he prophesied about the Israelites taking over the Canaanite land, he said, you know, it's not ready yet. They're not that bad yet. They're not that bad yet. There's no reason for me to go in and destroy an entire society, man, woman, child, when they're really not that wicked. But over a few scores of years or hundreds of years, they did get that bad, where now they were so bad, there was not a chance for any child to grow up and be in the remotest way righteous or good. It was just they were gone. There was society that was completely so Sodom and Gomorrah, I guess we could say, that God had to go in and destroy. But so again, God thinks differently than we do. And from this scripture in Romans 9, we see that God chooses leaders to fulfill his plan. God chooses leaders to fulfill his plan. You know, sometimes we think that in this republic, and we're not a democracy, we're a republic, we think that the United States individuals have the power to choose a president. Well, we choose an electorate body is what we do. So we don't have an election that is based on the one who wins the most votes. It's not a popular vote. But just taking a look at the men who've been in office who have never been voted for, did you know that 25%, over 25% of all presidents who ended up in office never had one vote cast for them? Over 25%. You know why that was? It was because of death in office and assassinations. There have been 8 men who were assassinated, 8 presidents, and the American people have never paid too much attention to the vice president, except the one came down from Alaska. I think she got more media coverage than most vice presidents. But other than that, you have 13 individuals that were vice presidents who would not necessarily have ever been president of the United States. 13. And then you have men who never got the popular vote. There's quite a few that fit into that category. So what I'm just saying is we think that we decide who will be the leader. And the answer is we don't. We don't. In fact, I think in sermons that I've given in the past, just looking at the statistics, it's over 50%, maybe 75%, 80% who would never have gotten into office except for God's intervention. So all world leaders are chosen by God to fulfill his plan. Let's go to Daniel 2, or 9, and verse 32. Now, I'm leading somewhere, so this is basically a precursor to what I am actually going to get into concerning what is happening in the world now at the end time and how the decisions of leaders fit into God's overall plan. And God is the one who's chosen those leaders who would make it happen. I don't think the scripture is actually going to be right. I think I marked the wrong one down. I think it's a little bit earlier here. It would be Daniel chapter 4. And I better change that for this afternoon, otherwise I'm going to repeat it. Okay, Daniel 4 and verse 32. Here's a vision that, or a dream that we know was, it was Nebuchadnezzar's dream, same guy as in Daniel 2. The name, if you do this, it was Belteshazzar, and it's like, it wasn't Belteshazzar who had the dream, that's Daniel. So you look down there and it's like, wait a minute here, do I have the wrong verse? But you have a dream by Nebuchadnezzar, and Daniel again is supposed to tell the king exactly what this dream is all about. And Daniel was very, very wise, because you'll see when Daniel started telling the king the dream, he said, "Let this dream be the dream of your enemies." That was a good way to start. We all need the wisdom of Daniel. Let this dream be the dream of your enemies. But he went on to say that if the king didn't change his ways, if he thought that he was the one responsible for all of these nice things in his empire, that God was going to take it from him. And, of course, about a year passed by, and Nebuchadnezzar, in his pomp and majesty, thought that he was the one responsible for all these good things in his kingdom. And then in verse 32, let's start in verse 31, while the word was still in the king's mouth, this again is Daniel 4, a voice fell from heaven, "King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it's spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. And they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make you eat grass like oxen, and seven times shall pass over until you know." Until he knows what? And this is these are three words that all of us need to keep in mind. Until you know. And I don't think the world at all knows this. Until you know, Nebuchadnezzar, and everybody needs to know this. Until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. That's just the way it is, bottom line. He's the one who does it. Until you know. And he had to eat nut crow. You know, we talk about eating crow, but in this case, Nebuchadnezzar had to eat grass. So maybe we should change that. I had to eat crow to I had to eat grass. That might be the best way. But that's the bottom line, and I have three points to bring out at this point, and that is, God intervenes quite often to just save us from a premature destruction. Otherwise, mankind would have caused this earth to blow up when it was possible, before God decided that the 6,000 years had ended. So God sometimes intervenes to slow down events, And I think we have a very good example of that at Dunkirk. And I still remember Elaine's husband giving a sermonette. I heard it on tape, I believe, or maybe he actually gave it over here. He was quite a storyteller, bringing out, you know, the Bible in ways that most of us can't. But whatever the case, the miracle of Dunkirk actually slowed Hitler from taking over the world. You cannot have a Hitler taking over then, even though it was Deutschland über alles or Ober alles, whatever it is. I'm not German. But he wanted Germany to be over all, the entire world. And also, I think he had a demon. He was a stargazer, basically, and he listened to soothsayers. Maybe that's not the terminology used today, but basically he decided to go into Russia way too early. Stalin was on his side, kind of. And so they had a treaty, at least. But anyway, he goes in. He goes in a little bit too late. He should have gone in maybe earlier in the spring. Whatever the case, he got stalled out by Stalin's troops. And you know what happened with his desire to bring or rein in, I guess we would say, Russia. Just didn't work out. But God intervened there because he did not want Hitler to take over. It wasn't the time yet. It's that same mind frame, the same beast, I think, the same spirit that took over Hitler, that will take over the beast in the end time. I fully believe that. So, one, God intervenes to slow things down. You don't want a premature death of the world. And number two, he intervenes to limit time going on. Matthew 24 and verse 22. Matthew 24 and verse 22 says the following. And all of us can remember. Unless those days were shortened, Matthew 24, 22, unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved alive. Not saved spiritually in this case, but no flesh saved alive. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened lest the world blows up. In other words, those people who are in a place of safety need to be saved. And if God didn't intervene, the hydrogen, the atomic warfare would kill everybody on this earth. And so there is a time coming that God is going to have to intervene. And so God then, as a result of what he's doing, has to choose leaders who will fulfill his plan. That's what it is. And he's in the leadership choosing business. So what is God's plan? Well, let's just take a quick look here. Our Jerusalem, at the end time we're looking at, Jerusalem, Zechariah chapter 12 and verses 1 through 4. It says, the burden of the word of the Lord against Israel. And we're going to read some correspondence from some articles that come out of Foreign Affairs and World News and out of Germany and different places that you will not hear on Channel 5 or CBS, NBC, you know, Fox News. They're dwelling on events that only partially have to do with what's going on in the world. Although maybe more so than that, since President Trump is in the news every single day, he's getting bashed every single day, so maybe there's more to it than the world would think, even though they're focusing on the right entity, President Trump. Chapter 12 of Zechariah. The burden of the word of the Lord against Israel. Thus says the Lord, who stretches out the heavens, lays the foundation of the earth, and forms the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the surrounding peoples when they lay siege against Judah and Jerusalem. So there's going to come a time when Jerusalem is going to be laid to have a siege against it again. Luke chapter 21 goes into that, where you have armies surrounding Jerusalem. Zechariah 14 also goes into armies surrounding Jerusalem. It'll happen that day that I'll make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. All who would heave it away will surely be cut in pieces, though all nations of the earth are gathered against it. All nations of the earth are gathered against it. In that day, says the Lord, I will strike every horse with confusion and its rider with madness. I will open my eyes on the house of Judah. I will strike every horse of the peoples with blindness. And he goes on. So we see at the end time, and we are leaning into Zechariah 14. If you don't think that this is concerning the end time, all you have to do is go two chapters forward. And it says, the day of the Lord is coming. And then it talks about Jerusalem again being laid siege. I will gather all nations to battle against Jerusalem. So it's in the same context of what's taking place. And it's a heavy stone and a burden, that is, Jerusalem is to all nations. And it's been that way now for decades, since basically the terrorists meaning Israel. Israel, remember, was the terrorists back in the late 40s. It wasn't the Palestinians who were the terrorists, it was Israel. And they were the ones blowing up, hotels and people and, whatever they could blow up to make some type of difference and gain a foothold in the Middle East and get their country back. So we have Jerusalem then a thorn. This is at the end time. Isaiah 10. What time do I have? I told someone it's going to be a long sermon because I can't get my watch out and I can't see what time it is. So, didn't we used to have something in here? I know I could bring my phone up here. It's 11 o'clock. And what time are we supposed to be out of here? Let's see. We start at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. Now. We have a whole hour. So anyway, it'll take a little while to read these news events, and you're going to see when I read the news events how they fit into prophecy and what's happening, what God is doing with world leaders. Again, I'll repeat that. But Isaiah 10, notice, says, it'll come to pass, verse 12 of Isaiah 10. It shall come to pass when the Lord has performed all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, that he will say, I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his hearty looks. So why is he saying that? Because God is going to use Assyria to destroy Jerusalem. And that starts back in verse 5, where it says, Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger. So, first and foremost, he says, Assyria is being used as my hammer, my .30-06, my bazooka, my 50 caliber gun that shoots at, 4 miles now, I think, in World War II. You could take a sniper and he could fire 800 meters. And now it's, I think I was told a couple of days ago by someone who was in the military that they have snipers and they can shoot 4 miles out. Now, if it wasn't 4 miles, it was 2, so maybe we should stick with 2. And when that 50 caliber bullet hits, there is so much power behind it that if somebody's standing next to the guy who gets hit, he dies too, unless it goes through soft tissue only. I think some of us get too involved in shooting, right? But anyway, when you're a minister, you hear a lot of stories from people who've been in World War II and in Korea and in Vietnam, because they can tell these stories. But whatever the case, we have Assyria, who's going to be used by God. Now, for Assyria to be used by God, you have to have God putting a leader in Assyria, who will do what God wants him to do. Now, he's not going to pick a good guy. He's going to pick someone who has a warlike spirit. And I think it's talking about the beast here, who's going to be over modern-day Assyria, which would be basically, we thought, Germany. It has to fit into Daniel chapter 2 and the resurrections of the Roman Empire. It has to, because you only have those four empires, and it's the Roman Empire that exists all the way until the coming of Jesus Christ. So it's an extension of the Roman Empire of years ago. And again, we have the resurrections of the Roman Empire. But notice verse 6 of Isaiah 10, I will send him against an ungodly nation. So Jerusalem is not a righteous city. It's a city that represents an ungodly nation. It's interesting that you have that term, because even when you hear these journalists or prognosticators talking about nations, they use the capital. They'll say Washington. They'll say Riyadh. They will say Damascus. Or they'll say Tel Aviv. Better yet, not Damascus. Tel Aviv is what they say. In other words, they're taking the capital of the country, which represents the entire country. And so in this case, you have Jerusalem, and it represents an ungodly nation. So you have Assyria coming in to conquer this whole nation, and they will. This is what happens at the end time. You go to Revelation chapter, let's see, I think we can go to chapter 11 just to see again what's going on at the end time. So Revelation chapter, now let's go back a little bit here. Pick it up. It's talking about the seals, seventh seal, it might be chapter 13 here. Yes, let's go to Revelation 13. So what we have in these first seven verses of Revelation 17 is the rising of beast power. This is Revelation 13. Get it right here, and verse 1. Revelation 13 and verse 1. If you ever wonder if I'm in the wrong spot, I look down, my wife will let me know right away. All I have to do, I have good peripheral vision. If I'm looking here, I can see my wife. And I appreciate that too, because I want to make sure you know where I am. So in verse 2, you see with this beast that the dragon gives him his power and his throne and great authority. Now, God allows Satan to do that. Basically, it's God saying to Satan, in a sense, you choose the leader, or I will choose a leader and you give him the power, whatever the case. Verse 4, they worship the dragon who gives authority to the beast. And then notice in verse 4, who is like the beast, who is able to make war with him? So you have a beast power that is tremendously powerful. How, we ask the question, how did this beast get to the point where he had the liberty to gain this much power? Where did his power come from? If we're thinking of Germany, can we look at Germany right now and say they have the arsenal to be used by a beast? And the answer is, you know, guess what was happening with the Treaty of Versailles? Or Versailles, whatever they say. That's the Treaty of World War I, and Germany was not supposed to have any military weaponry. And if they did, they would have to hide it, so guess what they did? Germany's known for making these Tiger tanks. They have some of the best tanks in the world, but after World War I, the tank had basically just been developed in World War I, and if you ever see the series on PBS, it's interesting to see what they first came up with. Wasn't very good. They got stuck in holes. They got blown up. You know, the first day they went out. Got stuck in the mud. All types of things happened with the first tanks. But they were in a development stage, and the Germans were some of the best. Now, we had a tank at the end of World War II that was really good, too. At the start of World War II. But you go back to World War I, and they were not supposed to be building tanks at all. But behind the scenes, there were engineers, German engineers, who were developing tanks, and they couldn't be built in Germany. They had to be built, guess where? They were built in Russia. They were built far out, kind of in Siberia almost. I forget the name of the place. It starts with a K. And they developed their tank for World War II. It was already in the development and in the manufacturing stage. In fact, they took down the plant in Russia and brought it over into Germany once the war started. But they had the tanks already developed. And you know where they tested them out? In Spain. Because there was a war in Spain just before, this was what, 1937, 38, maybe, before Germany invaded Poland. So they already had the means, and after a while, when the Allies found out that Germany was building these tanks, already Germany was too powerful, and they just kind of overlooked it. They didn't want to upset Hitler. They thought, well, just appease Hitler. That was the word that we use. He was appeased. We do that with our children. We appease our children, right? No, don't do it. Then they do it. Then we say no. Second time we say it, we've already appeased them, okay? We've let them do something. So appeasement is a word that the nations, the allies in Europe, were very good at doing. Chamberlain appeased Hitler. We know that. So we have at the end time these powerful entities, and we ask, how in the world does this happen? Because the United States has the power to control everything that's happening in the world right now, we have the power, but we have lost the pride of our power. So we're not going to use our power that we can. Now, we have somewhat, and I think there are seven regions of the world where we control those regions. There's seven regions. There's more regions of the world, but there's seven regions where we have a lot of control right now. But that's changing. That's changing. And we have two presidents that have been responsible for allowing nations to do what they want to do. And that's President Obama and President Trump. And I know all of you don't want to hear that President Obama and President Trump are in the same sentence. You don't like that at all, but they are. God chose the two of them because it wouldn't have been with President Reagan. When President Reagan was doing with the Russians were afraid of him. They called him the crazy cowboy. They didn't know what he was going to do. They thought that he was coming over and bombing them out. And he would come so close to the Russian boundary, and they would like, get the missiles ready. Then he'd turn around. And he had them scared silly. And, of course, we know what happened. It was because of President Reagan that we had the wall coming down. Now, President Reagan also played into the hands of prophecy because he's the one who brought the wall down, wasn't it? Or was it Kennedy? Get that wall down? I think it was Reagan, right? At least two of you, well, you know, two or three witnesses in the crowd here tell me I'm not too old and I'm still remembering some things. But by him saying, bring that wall down, he was also responsible, even though we loved him and we loved his strength, he was responsible for uniting East and West Germany. And we don't even think of that sometimes, that he was in on it too. God used him and used his strength because he was a strong president. And nobody was going to give him lip, but he spoke softly and carried a big stick. We have a president who doesn't speak softly and carries a big stick also, you know, at times he does. But we see that God is using him to fulfill his purpose also. So, what do we have then? A beast power. And I could go to Daniel chapter 12, but I'm not going there, but you have a king of the north that is very powerful, and the United States is not involved in any way with intervening in the Middle East. What did we have from President Trump's mouth this past week and a half? And that is, let the Europeans police the Middle East. How many of you heard that? Let the Europeans police the Middle East. And what's he thinking? Money. Money. It's one of the worst things that can happen. In fact, I think we really made a mistake when we were over in Iraq and we didn't actually take oil from the oil fields. You know, we take over and it's like use their oil to pay for going in there, and then we don't. Of course, they're burning the oil fields down. We would have to put some money into it, but we developed those oil fields in the first place, you know, with Mobil Oil and Shell and whatever. Our big companies built these oil fields in these other countries. That's because of our greed. We wanted the money, of course. But whatever the case, what's happening now? Well, here's some articles that I pulled up. Foreign Affairs, the article is by Shalom, probably an Irishman, Lipner. No, Shalom would be a Jew, I would think. How Obama and Trump Left a Vacuum in the Middle East, by Shalom Lipner. And this is November 25th, 2017. Once upon a time, all the experts said that America was a guarantor of security in the Middle East. Once upon a time. So you know what's coming in this article, and that is no longer. Why? Because of these two men, leaving a vacuum for another powerful country or a group of nations to fill. We can say that based on what we know about biblical prophecy. Down here a little farther, the world's worst kept secret is that Israel and Saudi Arabia are almost perfectly aligned in their opposition to Iran. So basically it's what it's saying is when the United States government pulls out, you have Israel making a partnership with a country. Otherwise, that if the United States hadn't backed out so much, they would not have made that partnership. The Obama's administration's support for the Iranian nuclear deal, which both countries opposed, So what you see happening is we do something, you know, we, with President Obama, and none of us like that Iranian deal, right? Well, guess what? Saudi Arabia didn't like it, Israel didn't like it, and now because they both oppose what the United States did, that didn't fare well with those two countries, and they get a little closer. They're more in partnership. It says, which both countries opposed, was the crucible of this new Israeli-Arab partnership. Going on down a little farther, in Syria, America in action, that's with the President Obama's administration, you know, he drew the line, they do this, and we're going to do this, and then, of course, he didn't do it. Well, we'll draw another line. And this has happened, you know, well, if they do this, well, okay, well, if they, kids, if you do this, I'm going to, you know, it's almost the same nature. If you do this, well, if you do that again, if you do it again, it's like, you know, so it's human nature to back off, isn't it? There's a reason to be strong. In Syria, American inaction has rehabilitated Russia as a destructive regional power and emboldened in the Iranian Confederates. Going on now, what about President Trump? Trump has certainly been less deliberate and consistent than Obama in his management of global affairs, but this remaking of the Middle East, and there's a term, by the way, that is used that we'll get to if we have time, and it's called MENA. It's an acronym. M-E-N-A. It's Middle East, North Africa. And when you look at the prophecy in Daniel, the last chapter in Daniel, you see that the European nations come down to the Middle East. They pass by Jordan. They get into the countries of the Middle East and all the way down into North Africa. So it's very interesting when you see this term. And I didn't even know the acronym existed until I was looking at some articles yesterday. Middle East, North Africa. Very much fitting into prophecy. So Trump has certainly been less deliberate than Obama in his management, but this remaking of the Middle East is their shared legacy. Now, what's happening right now with Israel and Saudi Arabia, I believe that's going to fall apart in the future. I don't think that association is going to last really too long. But whatever the case, you see now a vacuum in the Middle East and all types of things are happening because there is no guidance. There is no control, I guess we would say. Their message has been the same. If America's friends in the region aspire for enhanced security, they'd best not wait for the White House to provide it. And if recent events offer any indication, the message has been received loud and clear based on what's happening in the Middle East. And that goes on with some other things here that I don't know. I'll take time to read them except maybe once. One, and that is foreign leaders who recognize America's contribution to a stable world in the past are trying to wake the slumbering giant. In other words, we're asleep. We really don't know what's happening. What was happening before World War II, and what did the Japanese admiral say? We just awakened a sleeping giant, if I remember right. He was the admiral of the ship. If Pax Americana is dead in the Middle East, it's only because America has euthanized it. You know, put it to sleep. So that's just one article of five that I have, and I'll just read now a couple others. Some of them are short. This is from Defense One. It's how the United States and European aims overlap in the Middle East. I'm not going into the overlapping. I'm just going into a few sentences in the beginning of the article. This is August 15, 2018, by Mona Yakubian. In an era of global disorder propelled by the intertwined dynamics of globalization and proliferating technology, the Middle East and North Africa, then it said MENA. That's where I first saw. MENA. Stand out as perhaps the most, now listen to this, we're talking about the area of the world where the Europeans come down because they've been attacked. So you have a counterattack into this area of what we call MENA. And notice what it says here, the Middle East and North Africa stand out as perhaps the most chaotic region in the world. When you look at the entire globe, you talk about globalization. Disruption and dislocation will define the region's new normal. Disruption and dislocation, with reverberating impacts that will be difficult to contain. As both the United States and Europe have an interest in peace and stability in the region, cooperation will be critical to addressing this instability. So are we going to cooperate with Europe? And the answer is, yeah, we're going to cooperate with Europe. We're going to say, do what you want to do. We will definitely cooperate with it. We want to save money, okay? And we are basically isolationists all the way back to George Washington, all the way back to the beginning of our nation. We are isolationists. We do not want to get involved in the war. World War I started in 1914. We didn't get in until 1917, right? I think. And then World War II started in 1939. We didn't get in until 1941. We have, if you put a color to our nation, it's called white. We're a lumbering bear, and we will flee grizzlies, brown bears, more so brown bears and grizzlies, but we will flee unless our cubs are in danger. Then we will attack. But we want to stay out of it. We want to stay back. We're white. There's red, there's white. Red is Germany. White is the United States, I guess you'd say. Have any of you read the color, color personalities? And then you have, of course, the animal personalities of snakes and tigers and whatever it is. So the United States is red, white, and blue, but we're not. We're basically white. While there's a common transatlantic understanding of the main threats to peace and stability in the MENA region, the United States and Europe diverge most significantly in their approach and urgency concerning two. So where do we part from Europe? One is Iran and its long-term ambitions, and also the second is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That's where we have differences with Europe. And we're not going to care. If we don't have to spend the money to keep it all together, then we'll let other people keep it. In fact, I'm going to get ahead of myself. And we know that President Trump gave a call to Erdogan, if that's the way you pronounce his name, this past week. And it's a phone call that they talk about here. In the phone call 2 weeks ago, so this takes place a little bit before the announcement comes out that we're pulling out of Syria, Trump had been expected to deliver a standard warning to the Turkish president over his plan to launch a cross-border attack targeting U.S.-backed Kurdish forces in northeast Syria. I think all of us realize with Syria, you've got the Kurds from basically Turkey, Edom, that would be, who are our friends and allies, and they're fighting to get rid of the Assad power over there. The military put them out. And the Turks also are in there, and they also want to get Assad out. And then there's the Syrian rebels, another group. And then the United States also, along with Israel, who want them out. But now you got the Kurds in there and the Turks in there, and they are enemies. How does that work? So the Turks want to go in there and kill them because the Kurds say, the Turks say they're pretty close to this other group, Kurdish group over in Turkey, who have killed 40,000 of our people. So now, everything is just so non-chaotic. Everything is so organized. President Eisenhower would back out. He would say, I'm not going to take these forces at all. We have too much disruption. It was bad enough to have the French involved on D-Day back in, World War II. The French. They're always giving you problems. I think they wanted to have the say-so. But anyway, it's another story. And those of you who are much older than I am and in the history can give the details that I can't give. So, but instead of this phone call about, here's what we're going to do, in the course of the conversation, Trump reshaped U.S. policy in the Middle East. That's what happened in the last 2 weeks. Reshaped policy in the Middle East. Abandoning a quarter of Syrian territory and handing Ankara the job of finishing off Islamic State in Syria. Trump asked, if we withdraw our soldiers, can you clean up ISIS? Because that's why we were in there. Can you clean up ISIS? he said Erdogan replied that Turkish forces were up to the task, which the generals later said, oh, no. No, this is really tough. Now, then it says, then you do it, Trump told him abruptly to his national security advisor, John Bolton, also on the call. And John Bolton is a real dove. He just does not like any conflict at all. By the way, that's a knot. He loves conflict, John Bolton. Trump said, start work for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria. And then on a visit to a U.S. air base in Iraq this week, President Trump was talking to the military commanders, and he said, we've knocked them silly. I will tell you, I've had some very good talks with President Erdogan, who wants to knock them out also, and he'll do it. Give it to them. They can have it. So you see again, and what I'm leading up to here, or trying to show us all, is that God is using men to create a vacuum in the Middle East, which is happening, where another power comes in, not the United States, and not Britain. What is happening with Britain? Just as an aside, there are two verses here. What time is it? Yeah, there are two verses that I thought about when I was going through this. I had to look them out because I forgot where they were, but it has to do with Ephraim looking to its lover at the end time. And it's in Hosea chapter 8 and verse 9. Hosea chapter 8 and verse 9. And I thought of this when you hear that, well, you know, what are we going to do? We don't want to completely disconnect from the European Union. This is because, remember, the vote in Europe to leave the European Union, in Britain, to leave the European Union was like the vote in the United States, where they thought definitely they would not vote to leave the Union. Just like over here, President Trump will never be the president. I mean, the polls are accurate, right? They are. The polls are always accurate. Surprise, surprise, they missed the one in Britain. Britain decided to leave by a very small margin. And the United States, because of our popular vote, went over, of course, to the Electoral College. And based on the electoral votes, President Trump got the vote and is president of the United States. So over there, it's like, well, you know, we don't want to cut off from Europe entirely because it's going to hurt our economy. And so what do? It says, Hosea 8 and verse 9, like a wild donkey looking for a mate, they've gone up to Assyria. The people of Israel have sold themselves. And this is NLT. I think the word is Ephraim. Ephraim was a representative of all the northern kingdoms at the time. But basically, you're looking at Ephraim, which is Great Britain, have sold themselves to many lovers. And then in chapter 10, Israel is like a trained heifer treading out the grain, an easy job she loves. Hosea 10 and verse 1. But I will put a heavy yoke on her tender neck. I will force Judah to pull the plow and Israel to break up the hard ground. So you have all the nations, basically Ephraim representing the northern kingdom, Judah representing the southern kingdom. I will force Judah to pull the plow. So you have all of Israel, the time of Jacob's trouble, being talked about here at the end time. And Israel to break up the hard ground. In other words, it's going to be tough. And they're looking to Assyria as their lover. And that's what's happening right now. Great Britain is looking to the European Union. And Germany is the one who controls basically what's happening in the European Union. By the way, Churchill wanted a European Union, but he did not want government control to stay with that union. He wanted each separate country to have its own government and control. No union to control each country. He was against that. And of course, that didn't happen. In another article called The New Arab Order, and I think all of us can see now what's happening as we see what God is doing. Power and violence in today's Middle East. It's talking about in 2011, millions of citizens across the world took to the streets. This was the Arab Spring. Remember that term that was used? And they thought there would be a shift in the Middle East, but it didn't happen. But there was a change, it goes on to say. The upheaval did, in fact, create a new Arab order. The proliferation of failed and weakened states has created new opportunities for competition and intervention favoring new actors and new capabilities. And then it says, the new order is fundamentally one of disorder. Again, talking about the Middle East, disorder. The catalog of despair in the Middle East today is difficult to fathom. I mean, these are some very striking statements that are coming. This one from Mark Lynch is the name of the... Mark Wynot wrote this. No, it's Mark Lynch. Power and violence in today's... And listen to this. Power and violence in today's Middle East. In this new environment, he goes on to say, it makes sense for even close U.S. allies to build relationships with China, Russia, and the EU, as Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, the United Arab Emirates, and even Jordan are now doing. They are what? They're becoming building relationships with China. China will do nothing when there is an initial attack. China is going to allow that attack from the European Union. And Russia is going to allow that attack also. And then you have the EU. But the three are together. Notice a relationship with those three countries who are now friends. They're not enemies. The Trump administration has struggled to manage these new realities. Trump's sudden policy changes and the wildly incoherent messaging that is coming from different parts of the United States government are confusing allies and adversaries alike, confusing them. So it says down here, the United States no longer has the power or the stand to impose a regional order on its own terms. In all likelihood, U.S. Hegemony, I used to call it hegemony, but I looked up to see exactly what that word means. It's dominance basically by one country. So why don't they just say dominance by one country rather than putting a word in here that we have to look up? That's what I've wondered. So, but the United States no longer has dominance. By our nation, because we've been dominant. In the Middle East, will never be restored. Our dominance will never be restored, is what it says. And finally, I'll end with this. I thought it's very interesting. It's Germany in the Middle East, Encyclopedia of the Modern Middle East and North Africa. There you go again. Middle East and North Africa. We'll have to look the history of that up because there's more to that than you think, except that Egypt, even back in the time of Israel being a strong nation, the time of David, the time of Solomon, you had Egypt as a strong nation. You had fights and you had Egypt being a very strong country, and that's North Africa. And also you see in Daniel 11 where they go down to, that is, Europe goes down and conquers Egypt and Ethiopia, it says, which is interesting. So it gives a little history, which I won't go into just because of time, on the policy, the German Middle East policy is what we're looking at here. And basically up until about 1990, with the invasion of Kuwait the first time, President George Bush 41, okay, because that's what they're doing now, 41 and 43, so you know which one, supported the United Nations. So Germany did support the United Nations when Iraq went into Kuwait, remember? And so we've got to get Iraq out of Kuwait, and the first President Bush did and went to the borders, pushed them in, but did not go into Iraq. But anyway, Germany joined the U.S.-led coalition of 28 states by sending air units to Turkey, contributed minesweepers, and pledged $5.5 billion to the war effort. After that, when we wanted to go in the second time, they said, no, prove to us that there is nuclear weapons of mass destruction. And if we couldn't prove to Germany that there were weapons of mass destruction, they weren't going in. And now it's questionable. Although I question them being questionable, because you can hide nuclear weapons, I suppose. But whatever the case, The Gulf Crisis and the war that followed damaged Germany's general friendly relationship with the United States and Britain. So that's when you had a parting of interests right there. Now, I'm going to quote something here from a German journalist, Christoph Horstel, who does not represent the present policy of Germany. But I just want to show you what's brewing in Germany, so to speak, and what this man calls for. Germany's role in Syria and in the Middle East is what this guy is talking about. He says Germany's actual policies range a far cry from what is possible and constructive. And I would say what is possible and is going to be destructive, because it will be if it actually comes to pass. This globe is a very dangerous place, with most of the troubles basically linked to one single capital, Washington. So who's getting the blame for all that's happening? Washington. Going on, in the Middle East, Washington maintains two dangerously close connections of cooperation, detrimental, in fact, to all three sides, the United States, Tel Aviv, and Riyadh. So you've got detrimental to all three. But going down, what could be rightly and fairly expected from Germany in this multiply complicated, difficult case of ME politics, Middle Eastern politics? Generally speaking, in all following country cases, German could well use its influence to help limit U.S. and other NATO countries. So this is what this guy is calling for. We've got to limit the United States. I don't think they're going to have to do it. I think the United States is going to say, you know, we have NATO over there. You can have all our weapons. We'll just leave them there. That's what we do anyway, right? We don't necessarily pull our weapons out. In World War II, I think we left a lot in other countries. But whatever the case, I think we're going to give them what they want. Just give them what they want. It's a lot cheaper, you know. And then gets into several countries, and I just have about five highlights here. Number one, help stop Washington-backed and coordinated interferences in Syria's internal affairs. Get Washington out of Syria. With Iran, help unite the EU and others in support of Iran against illegal sanctions by Washington. You think this guy loves Washington? He's a alleged Holocaust denier. That's what he is, alleged. He won't admit it. Then in Palestine, break the blocking of Gaza Strip by Israel and give generous assistance to all impoverished Palestinians against cessation of armed attacks. Give assistance to the impoverished Palestinians, okay? And then recognize the statehood of Palestine, recognize their statehood, freedom and full return of all Palestinians into their legitimate homelands. What do you think about that? And then finally it says, in Egypt, assist return of the rule of law. And this is interesting. Germany has armed Israel with 6 Dolphin-class submarines at 30% price reduction. Israel has added nuclear capabilities, the whole system exceeding all comparable NATO weaponry. In other words, Israel is that strong. So it's interesting that Germany is giving weapons to a country that is going to be looked upon as a nation that is too powerful because of German assistance in this case, and is going to cause eventually the same group that gave them the weapons to come down and take over of Israel. And what do you do? It's interesting. Now, in all of this, I have a final wrap-up, and that is, God doesn't think the way we think, right? And I wrote some things down as I was putting the sermon together, and that is, it's on another piece of paper here. It's on this one. Okay, why do we think that we can choose the right leader? When you look at all of this and what God is doing, why do we think that we can have any part in doing anything with the right leader? So I think I should have been president, actually. I think Bob Howell should have been president, and Matt Capel, and Ray Harris, and Bill Beecham, and you name it. Every single one of us in this room could be the president of the United States and do a righteous job. The others are not doing a righteous job. So we can't choose the right leader. Do we know what God has in mind for any period of time throughout history? And the answer is no. Would we have chosen Nebuchadnezzar to rule Babylon? About Xerxes, Alexander the Great, Augustus Caesar, and Napoleon? Well, God had a whole 6,000-year history plan, and maybe we should say 4,400-year history plan since the flood. How would we know to vote for any president to do any job? And that's, we don't. We just don't know because God thinks so high. He's got his ideas of what he's going to do, and he's going to make sure whoever he wants in office will be in office. So basically, we should have a party every time a president is elected. Let's drink to this guy, you know? This is great. So God makes things happen through world leaders, and he chooses them all to make his plan come to fruition. That's what he does. Does God care as much about the little things that are happening in politics? Well, God does. There is a scripture, and I won't turn to it, but it says in Romans that we are to pray for our leaders so that the church can exist in peace, no matter who the leader is, no matter whether we like them or not. And I'm like you. I don't like certain personalities. I don't like certain guys. I don't like guys who I think are Muslims. You know, I'm the same way all of you are. Like, I think he's a Muslim. I don't think he's a Christian. He never went to church one time while he was in office in 8 years to a Christian church. But these Christian churches, what are they anyway, you know? So we take a look at it, and we get a perspective on all of this, but it's not just can we choose these men. It's us taking a look at the decisions that are being made in the United States and Britain and in all of the countries of Jacob, so to speak, and thinking, you know, God is fulfilling his plan. We, because of our sins, are weak, and we are going to be cursed. All of Jacob's kids, all the Israelites will be cursed. There will be a time of Jacob's trouble. And in the meantime, we are going to not use power. We're going to defer, I guess the word would be, to other countries to take over. And that's God's plan. So I hope that gives us peace. We can go to sleep easier at night. We don't have to have stress and have a heart attack. You know, we don't have to go through these things, but we take a look, and I want us all in this sermon to just take a look at a perspective from prophecy and take a look and shine the predictions that God has in the Bible to what events are transpiring in the world today.